a year or two from now, then the course has been successful. So treat the final like that. It's not like some kind of punishment or something like that. It's just things that I really want you to know and to pass on to your own students, okay? All right. The way I usually do this is I just go around the room and embarrass people in order. And people pull out their notes and start reading them, and that's the whole idea. So I'll start over here with friend Diane. These are the points that I think are important, most important. Okay. Sanskrit word for Buddhist discipline? Oh, that's tough. Tibetan word? Dulwa means what? And to tame in two senses. Dhammabhadra says to tame in two senses. Remember? You're taming two things, basically. Yeah, that's number two. To control your senses, your desire for sense objects, which will make you a lot happier, even if you never do anything else. And number one was the ultimate purpose of Vinaya is what? Yeah, which is controlling the... Yeah, which is taming the mental fixations. That's just logical. I mean, if the goal of Vinaya is to reach Nirvana, then the word Dulwa or Vinaya, which means to tame, is you're taming the mental afflictions. You are taming them in the sense of wiping them out. And you're also taming your sense desires. Okay, those two things. That's what Dhammabhadra says. And what you use to tame yourself is primarily the first seven of the ten, avoiding the first seven of the ten Vedas. That's primarily what the Vinaya is all about. Okay. It says, describe the relationship between the Buddhist discipline, Lord Buddha, and his teachings. Do you remember anything like that?
I think you know what Buddha himself went through to get to where you are. Mm-hmm. Then follow the teachings and understand as well.
Mm-hmm. And we had a quotation in Vinaya the other day. What was that? We looked it up. We looked up the sutra which gave the answer to this question. And we were concerned because we were reading a text with the monks and nuns, and the text didn't seem to read very well. And then we found another Tibetan commentary that had the quotation in a little bit better form. And then we finally found it in the original sutra, and it was even more complete. And then we finally figured out what the quotation meant. And remember? Come on. Really? It said... Duwa ni temba dan temba ngoyin. Duwa ni temba dan temba ngoyin. Temba and temba both. Ngoyin. Remember? Nah. We spent a long time on it. Anyway, the point is that the Vinaya, there's a statement in Sutra where the Buddha himself says, the Vinaya is the teacher and his teachings. The Vinaya is the teacher himself and the teachings themselves. Okay. Why? Why is the Vinaya the teachings of the Buddha? I mean, there's this part of the sutra where it says if you were stuck on a desert island and all you had was a book of Vinaya, you could say, I have the whole Buddha's teachings. Kochupa means in Tibetan, one book of Vinaya is a reasonable approximation of the entire Buddha's teachings. Period.
Okay. The essence of the practice, that's the way of living.
Yeah.
And your concentrative level when everything ripens from having an ethical way of living.
Yeah.
You want to have a deep concentration level when they notice the emptiness.
Yeah. So but that's just a direct quotation. That the if all you had to take was if you could only take one book out of the whole canon, if you took one book of Vinaya, it would represent the whole canon. That's from Sutra. It would be the same as having the whole canon, the whole teachings of the Buddha. And then after that the Buddha says, and by the way, it is also represents the presence of myself. You know, one book of Vinaya represents the presence of the Buddha himself because it teaches you what to give up and what to follow and what to give up. Okay, and that's just a very famous sutra. It says the Vinaya is the teacher and the Vinaya is the teachings, all of them. Okay. It's an advertisement for Vinaya. Okay. Mr. Siller, since you halfway answered it already, name the three extraordinary trainings, and then explain how the extraordinary, by the way, they're called extraordinary trainings, right? We don't call them just the training of morality, for example. Why? Do you remember? They actually don't call them the three trainings. They call them the three extraordinary trainings. Do you remember why? Yeah, but also that it's to distinguish generally the general practice of an ethical way of life from a Buddhist practice of an ethical way of life. So these are the three trainings as practiced by a Buddhist for the purpose of reaching nirvana and Buddhahood. And that makes them extraordinary. Like, other people can practice meditation, other people can practice an ethical way of life, other people can try to understand reality, but that doesn't qualify as training, as a Buddhist training. Buddhist and extraordinary here are the same thing. They have to be, if they are aimed at reaching nirvana and Buddhahood, then they are extraordinary trainings. What role does the extraordinary training of an ethical way of life play in developing the other two extraordinary trainings? And say it again, you said it pretty well.
Well, you know, the three trainings are the Pravashana training.
The training in ethical lifestyle, A. B.
Right thoughts.
Concentration.
Concentration and wisdom.
Yeah. Ethical way of life, concentration, and wisdom. And how are they interconnected?
Because you can never get to the second and third without having an ethical way of life.
Yeah, and you can't get to the third without the second, and you can't get to the second without the first. Basically like that. And Jetsun Kapa, in his letter to... in the first letter you had, in that epistle to Lawan Dakpa, okay, he said the same thing. He said, by his time, 1400, people had forgotten what? They've forgotten the connection between living good, a good life in your day-to-day life and in your meditation. That you can never learn to meditate well if you weren't good during the day, you'd never be able to meditate at night, period. Can't do it. And, you know, I have a lot of Americans come to me and say, you know, I've been practicing for 10 years or 20 years. I've never reached shamatha. I don't even know what it's like. I can't concentrate. Nothing's going right. You know, I do all these sadhanas, nothing happens. And I believe that it's mainly connected to not following pratimoksha. And I believe among them, for Americans, the ones of speech are the most difficult. You know, that we just, it's almost considered a virtue in our country to blab, you know, idle talk. And I'm speaking from experience, okay? And I think that's a big obstacle for us. Okay. And then Jetsun Kapa, in that letter, he compares an ethical way of life. He says an ethical way of life leads to a calm state of mind, and the calm state of mind is necessary for the moon of what? Emptiness to reflect in it. So it's almost like you either have to speed your mind up or slow your mind down to the speed of emptiness. And that we are all constantly on a different wavelength than emptiness. I mean, a different sync. We can never get in sync with emptiness because our mind is too fast or too slow. And there are emptinesses all around you all the time, and you just don't... They go over your head because your mind's moving at a different speed. And that speed is regulated by your morality. Okay, so the idea is to clean up your life, which puts your mind at a different speed, and then it becomes like a mirror, and then emptiness can reflect in that mirror, as the moon can only reflect in a pond which is still. And if it's choppy, you don't get a nice moon. Okay. Señor, name the early Sanskrit commentary which forms the basis of the study of Buddhist discipline in Tibetan monasteries. Give the author and his approximate date. Okay, approximate date. This is the Vinaya Sutra by Gunaprabha. And try to say master, okay? It's considered impolite to call somebody Nagarjuna or Tsongkhapa or like that. Approximate date, which we don't really know very well. Do you know the 500 AD, okay? Approximately. Okay, I'll ask you another question. Is the Vinaya Sutra a sutra? Is the Vinaya Sutra a sutra?
I mean, there are different meanings of word sutra.
Oh, good. That's a good way to answer. If I define sutra as in its normal way, which is as an open teaching of the Buddha, as opposed to tantra, which is a secret teaching of the Buddha, the open teaching of an enlightened being, is the Vinaya Sutra an open teaching of an enlightened being? Which means, is it in the Kangyur, for example? The canon has two parts, Kangyur and Kengyur. Kangyur is the part that we have in Tibetan, which was spoken by enlightened beings, normally Shakyamuni, but not necessarily Shakyamuni. And that's about 1,500 separate works. Then we have the Tengyur, which is the early Sanskrit commentaries, before about 900 AD, and those were written by non-enlightened beings. So where does the Vinaya Sutra go, in the Tengyur or the Kangyur? Huh?
Kangyur.
Okay. Was it spoken by a Buddha?
No.
No, so it's in the Tengyur. Okay. It's a Shastra. It's a commentary on a sutra. Okay. It's a commentary on the Patimoksha Sutra. Okay. Oh no, sure. But what I'm saying is that the Vinaya Sutra is not a sutra. It's a misnomer. Okay? And you should know. The Vinaya Sutra, which is the main book used for the study of Vinaya in Tibetan monasteries, is not a sutra. It's called sutra because sutra also means short book. And it's a short book. So be careful. I mean, somebody says, what are you studying? You say Vinaya Sutra, you know. And then they say, is it a sutra? And you have to say, no, it was written 1,000 years later by Master Gunapama. It's not a sutra. It used to confuse the heck out of me. And I would search through the Kangyur catalogs for this sutra, and it's not there, you know, okay? Carol Ram. Describe the motivation with which one should engage in a study of Buddhist discipline. Yeah, renunciation. Okay? Renunciation. And in fact, there's this big debate in the Vinaya scriptures about if you don't have renunciation and you try to take monk's vows, if they even ever form in you. You know, if you don't have a single thought of renunciation during the ceremony, is it possible for the vows to form? And as I remember, it says no. Okay? They don't ever form. So the reason to do Vinaya, Jetsun Khapa, and I'm going to quote from his letter. He says, if keeping up this ethical way of life becomes for us something motivated only by a concern about how we look to others or about the honor and gifts we might obtain thereby, then the real point of ethics is lost. In other words, ethics which is motivated by how you look, by a concern for conforming to what other people do or worrying about how other people might like you or won't like you or something like that, it's not the proper motivation for practicing Vinaya. Okay. For taking Pratimoksha vows. It has to be that you are tired of being unhappy and that you want to be happy. I mean, everybody has that, but it has to be why you take the vows. And you, if you follow the vows, you can be happy. Okay. The whole Pratimoksha teachings, the whole Vinaya teachings, and especially Vinaya Sutra, has three sections. I mean, you can break the whole thing down into three sections, three main sections that relate to the Pratimoksha vows. Do you remember what they are?
Is it how to get them?
Yeah, how to get them if you don't have them, number one.
How to keep them?
How to keep them if you do get them.
Yeah,
how to fix them if you break them. Okay, and there's nothing in Vinaya that doesn't fit into one of those three categories. So I think it's just good in your mind to have that overview of the Vinaya teachings, you know, that's all there is in the Vinaya Sutra, is those three sections. Okay. Tess, when you get to the part about how to keep your vows from being damaged, there's four main sections. And do you remember what they are? That was number two. What was number one? Logically. Yeah, outer support, which is what?
Remembering your pure intention when you first put
the back. No, that's the inner support. How's the outer support? When a monk first becomes a monk.
Oh, being under the guidance of
Yeah, you have to go find a Nei Lama. A Nei Lama. Nei Lama means a personal monastic preceptor, a personal mentor. So when you become a monk, you have to go look for a Nei Lama. And it's considered extremely important. When you study the subject of prioritization of ethics in the monastery, which means if two events come together at the same time, like if you're supposed to do two things at the same time, which do you do first? You know, you have to drop one of them. And the classic example is you lost your Nei Lama, you lost your preceptor, and it's also time to go to Sojo. It's also time, you know, at 7 o'clock it's time to go do your Sojo with all the other monks. What do you do? I mean, do you wait the 2 hours until Sojong is over and then go find a preceptor? Or do you drop Sojong, which is one of the three great bases of all monastic practice? Do you drop that, which was almost unheard of, and go try to find this preceptor? I mean, is 2 hours that important? And the answer is,
but you know, if you
don't, but you know. Not necessarily. No, it's not contradictory to go into Sojin to look for your Nei Lama and not do Sojin. But the answer is, I mean, this is the theory of prioritization, which we did not get into. It's called Dom. But it's what's more important. You always have to do what's more important at any given moment. And that's true of all your Buddhist practice. I mean, there may be very good things to do which are not ultimately important at that moment. And the answer is you go find your Nei Lama. You drop Sojo. Even if it's only 2 hours. Even if it's only saving you 2 hours, you go find your Nei Lama. You know, that's how important it is. Sojo is one of the three great foundations of all monastic practice, along with the summer retreat and the end of the summer retreat. But you drop it like a hot potato and you go find your Nei Lama. So it's that important. The outside support for keeping your vows. And I repeat, you know, there are two things you're allowed to do without your Nei Lama's approval, which is brush your teeth and go to the bathroom. Okay, everything else you have to ask your Nei Lama for 10 years. And then you're considered stable. Tembo, it's called, okay? Same thing. Okay, inner support. Yeah, and that's very important. I mean, I always say that, you know, I can't judge people who have given up their vows. I'm not judging the people in America, for example, who have given up their monk's vows and nun's vows. I can't know that there isn't some special thing going on where some tantric deity appeared to them and said it would be useful if you gave up your vows today. You know, and in such a case, I think you would have to give up your vows. And so I believe that's possible. But if that's not the case, I don't understand why anyone would want to give up their vows. Because the motivation with which you take your vows is what? You're just tired of being unhappy. And you recognize that those worldly activities cannot make you happy. And so it's impossible to give up your vows for that reason. It's impossible to give up your vows to be happy. It's in contradiction of terms. It's impossible. If you understand anything about the vows, and if you took them with any kind of renunciation, then it's impossible to want to give them up to be happy. It's impossible. I mean, and so, conversely, if you always remember why you took your vows, which is because you don't want to be unhappy, you'll always keep them. And that's why they're considered the second force that keeps you from having your vows damaged. And they really do make you happy. If you understand them and you understand the theory behind Vinaya and you keep your Vinaya, it just makes you quite content and quite quietly happy your whole life. Quite cool, you know. Okay. I mean, you meet monks and nuns who are not happy. I would say they're not keeping their vows probably. And I don't mean they're out partying and stuff like that. But I mean, they've lost somehow the spirit of keeping their vows. But if you find, but if you're keeping your vows with the full spirit, and if you understand why you're keeping your vows, that just makes you extremely happy, your whole life, extremely contented. Your mind is just in some kind of great happiness most of the day. except for when your boss is right in your face. Okay, number three.
Understanding what factors damage the valves.
Yeah, which means to know what the valves are. I mean, you'd be amazed how many monks, even in the monastery, and myself, I mean, I can't list for you off the top of my head 253 valves that I have. And the nuns, I mean, a full nun has 364. You're supposed to be able to, and you must study them so that you know your vows. And that's especially important for those of you who have bodhisattva vows and secret vows. I don't believe that most of the people in our group, including New Jersey and Washington, who have tantric vows, understand all of the vows or their bodhisattva vows. And that then you're going to break them. So the best way, not one of the most important things, not to break them. I mean, obviously have an external support, which is some kind of guide, some kind of spiritual guide. Have the internal support, which is your own intentions of not wanting to be unhappy anymore. And then thirdly, learn your vows well. You know, take the time to study them carefully, and then you won't break them. And then number four. Yeah, which is. Which relates to people who have taken vows, and specifically to novice monks and nuns and full monks and nuns, which means there are like 100 special rituals that we do. There's like 100 special monastic practices. I've mentioned the top three, which is keeping your confession ceremony, doing your summer retreat, and then the practice of coming out of your summer retreat. Those are the great three monastic practices, but there are like 100 of them, 100 total of 100 and something. Okay. Okay, Miss Ellie. In the opening lines of this text, Jetsun Kapa mentions that the vows of individual freedom, which is pratimoksha vows, okay, constitute the subject matter of the scriptures on Buddhist discipline. I mean, Vinaya is the subject. Vinaya is the book. Vinaya is the teachings, and what they teach is the pratimoksha vows. Their subject matter is the pratimoksha vows. Why are they called pratimoksha? Yeah, very simple. They're called individual freedom vows, pratimoksha, because if you keep them, you get free. And if you fail to keep them, you don't get free. Free means free from your mental afflictions, okay? Free from samsara. There is also an explanation which you do not have to write on your homework, or I mean on your exam, but just so you know, there's an alternate explanation that says prati also means for the first time. Moksha means free. And when you take these vows, you are for the first time in this life freed from the condition of not having vows. And then there's this huge debate about, well, should we not call them prati moksha from the first minute on, you know? You know, big debate. Okay. Anyway, in some of the ancient Vinaya texts, that's what they say for pratimoksha. Bill Gross, you ready? In his little book about Vinaya, which is the shortest text on Vinaya I think you can find in the universe, which is all we got through, Jetsun Kapa covered 6 different subjects. In the text it says, Ngo damni rabi dam sosong munzi gyawe dam tongi gyu dam peyi dam namba dhugi jishin shay. Those are the 6 subjects. Do you remember any of them? Ngo meaning, what is a vow? What is a pratimoksha vow? Okay. And then he said rabye, which is, do you remember what that is? Then he said divisions. Then he said, Munzin, which is what? Do you guys want to help? Yeah, Munzin means he's going to describe what the vow is. Then, Kewe, Ten. Yeah, Ten means who can take them. Okay. This is what our study of Vinaya covered. We covered these 6 subjects. Number 5, Tongwegyu. Yeah, how you lose them. And number 6 was Penyun, the benefits of keeping them. Okay. So whenever you think of Vinaya, you can think of it like that. You know, what is a pratimoksha vow made of? What is pratimoksha morality? And then, ngo dami rabye dan, How many different groups of pratimoksha vows are there? 모아다니라미 소송원진. What are the vows for each of those kinds of people? Like, what are the one-day vows? What are the novice vows? Like that. 소송원진. 계획된. Who can take them and who can't take them? 동의기운. What makes you lose them? Did I miss one? No. 동의기운. 폐인대. Pain means what happens if you keep them? You know, what are you going to get out of it? Right? Why should you take them? Right? Okay. Those are just the six categories. When we get to law, which is, means what is Pratimoksha morality? Go ahead. He had 2.5 lines. He said, that's his definition. There's four elements there. First is Nyenjin.
Okay. You want to take them because
of renunciation. Yeah, you are tired of being unhappy. Okay. You're just tired of being unhappy. Nyenjin sampe gyuchene. Excuse me? Yeah, shene means refrain from hurting other people, other living beings. Shene, and then it says along with the basis.
Which is the last three.
Yeah, because technically speaking, the Pratimoksha morality refers to the first seven bad deeds of body and speech. Shidan chepale, dopa means to refrain, to stop. Okay, and that's the, I mean, if somebody asks you what is the essence of Pratimoksha, you could say, means for the reason that you are tired of being unhappy. To refrain from hurting other people, other beings, and to refrain from the basis of that, which is the lousy thoughts that make you hurt other beings. Okay? Alright? Cool. Where are we next? Are we up to Banzan yet? Okay. Oh, Vilma's hiding back there. Alright. It's pretty cool. Four primary rules of the one-day vow.
No sensual activity.
Good, number one.
No stealing.
Okay.
No killing and no lying.
Good, okay. I'll repeat them. Mitsamba Chupa means any sexual activity at all during the whole day. It's a one-day vow. The four principal rules of the one-day vow. No sexual activity at all. Rintan Sawe Mupo Majimba Lemba, which means to steal anything of value. Okay. Number three, someone asked me about, and I checked it, okay? It does say Mia Mir Chakpar Sok Chupa, which means to kill a human or a human fetus. Okay, because I remember I chopped that right out of text, you know, with the computer, so I didn't even change it, I just chopped it out and stuck it in the answer column there. So, you know, technically, but of course it's, on that day it's important to refrain from any kind of killing, but technically, according to the commentary we've studied, it's to kill a human or a human fetus. And then, Nichir Lame Zundumawa, he takes the time to mention the ultimate form of lying, which is what? To lie about your spiritual attainments, particularly having seen emptiness directly. And then by implication, you know, claims that you could only make if you... claims which you could probably only make if you had seen emptiness directly. For example, claiming that you could see your future lives or your past lives or things like that. Okay? When you had not. Okay.
So this one-day vow, no killing food, implies that you are for this day refraining from eating meat? Or?
Normally, in the Mahayana version, we do. But eating meat and killing... I mean, the classical answer is that I don't go to the McDonald's to kill a cow. I go to McDonald's to eat a hamburger. And so that's the... They say that's... That's why they can eat meat and it's not killing. Now, you know that if no one ate meat, no one would kill any animals. And that you have to work out. But Taishin Sojong, in the Mahayana version of these vows, we refrain from eating meat. I don't recall anything in the text about, in this Hinayana pratimoksha morality of not eating meat for that day. I don't recall anything like that. I think the principle in ancient India was you eat what they give you. You know, you go to a house and you're not allowed to refuse. If they throw shrimp in your bowl and you have to eat it. And I think that was why the monks were eating meat in ancient India. Okay. But I'm not a great Vinaya master, and I hope to become, and I'm working on it. Okay. Mr. Weiner. The five rules and the one additional part of the lifetime layman's vow. Yeah, I guess so. Let me see.
So, well, not committing adultery, which is a small variation.
Yeah, yeah, you can have sexual activity, but you can't have adultery. Yeah, not killing a human or sukha mada lopariyam. Sukha is killing. Gu means stealing anything of value. Ma means stealing, lying about your spiritual attainments especially. Lopariyam, adultery, instead of just any kind of general sexual.
And that specifically means not having sex with someone who's married?
Yeah. Normally.
And then intoxication or not drinking? Because that's what people say, intoxication.
Oh, any kinds of intoxicant.
Right.
The text says chima or chima mayimba, meaning chemical or natural. You know? Lopa yamba doesn't have to mean just adultery. Okay, it can mean all those other kinds of sexual misconduct too. Okay. I think the primary one here is adultery.
So can you clear it for us?
Because yeah.
Sometimes you say it this way, sometimes you...
Yeah, generally the word lopa yamba refers to all the ones I mentioned when we went over karma. You know, all those kinds of sexual misconduct. But I'll check it. I'll check it for you.
And the attitude doesn't matter if it's the
time
of day you do it. I'm sure.
How do you mean attitude?
That you're approaching sexual activity.
Oh, no. If it's between consenting adults, it doesn't matter why. I've never seen a thing, unless you're intending to hurt someone or something like that. You know, where it would hurt somebody was listed in the... You know, if it's done with malicious intent, you want to ruin their reputation or something like that, yeah. They don't say. Doesn't say. No. Let me see here. Yeah, but I believe it's. I don't know. I'll see if it's specifically adultery. Maybe I'll do it right now. Elizabeth, can you get my computer out of my briefcase? Okay. Okay. Oh wait, it's here. Hang on. Yep, it's adultery. Now I have the Tibetan here. It's a rangi pume mayimbala lopayama, which means to have sex with someone who's... It says not your wife, but what it means is someone else's wife.
Does it imply that if you are single or you are not single, you know, like...
No. Well, you can be single and have adultery with someone else's wife, for example. And that would be...
And adultery. This is adultery. What about if you are married and the woman is not married?
It's still adultery. Yeah, it is specifically adultery. It's not the other kinds of sexual misconduct. Okay. In his commentary, in Dhammapada's commentary, because it's here in the Tibetan. Okay. What was the extra part? Which we almost forgot.
Never break the advice of going for refuge.
Yeah, do you remember some of them? Did we go over some of them? I don't remember. The advices for taking refuge? Yeah.
can you say again what you're talking about? Because
we better get it out. Can you? I better give you a little course in that. Okay, we'll do that. We'll do that after the break. Okay, it's something you're all supposed to be keeping if you take these vows. Okay, I think I'll give this one to Ellie. That's okay. It's Vinaya, right? The number of full monk's vows by naming each of the six groups. By the way, it's classically five groups, but one of them is normally split into two, right? And stating the number of vows in each group. Hama geda, famani, tusun bandu sunju da, duje bashi guju da, soso shaba shuji da, nechi geda.
That's good.
What is it? Pam, pamba shi.
Oh, no, 40 feet, 8 down.
Wait, what? 40 feet, pamba shi da, famani. How many remainders? Choksun. 13. Pambashidan hamani, choksun pang tum sumjudan. Pangwai tumje sumju. How many? 30 pang tum. Okay. By the way, we'll go through, why is it called a pamba? A defeat. Well, something like you've been defeated by the mental affliction. And pretty much your vows are pretty much really seriously damaged, extremely, immensely damaged, okay? Thank you. Thanks. That's all, yeah. Phagma? Remainder? No, why are they called remainder?
Why are they called remainder? Because
there's a little bit left to confess, okay? There's a little bit left that you could restore. Okay? Pama Chusum, 13 for a monk. Pangdung Sunju? You could say downfaller, okay? Downfall. But the kind that involves giving up something.
Okay?
The kind that involves giving up something. Which is Pangdung Sunju. 30. Okay. What does it mean to give up something?
You have to do like an antidote.
Well,
it's whatever you have, you have to give it back.
You know, something, you know, it normally involves some kind of possession that you weren't supposed to have that long, or, you know, like cloth that you weren't supposed to keep. A monk is not allowed to keep cloth more than 10 days without using it for robes, or basically not allowed to possess things, which we didn't get into much, but it's a very... it's a very sweet part of the Vinaya, you know. That monks just, I mean, the whole point is that you don't possess things. And you're not allowed to possess cloth unless you use it. And if you don't use it, you're supposed to get rid of it.
Okay.
So, Pang Tung, and then Tungje Bashi, which means just a downfall, meaning you don't have to give up anything. Tungje Bashi, what's that? It just means... Bashi means just a downfall, which means you don't have to give up something to fix it. Tungje Bashi Guchu, 90. Anybody Guchu da? Soso Shapa Chuji da? Yeah, have to be confessed individually by each monk before Sojo, during Sojo. Soso Shapa Chuji, I think it was 11, right? Soso Shapa Chuji, okay, that's for a nun. Sosha Shida Nyeji Ni, Gyadon Chuni, 112 Nyejes, which are what? Yeah, it's just sort of, they're sort of more minor, you know, mistakes or bad things. Okay, whose turn is it now? Aura? Ready? Aura. Five things that can make you lose any one of the Pratimoksha vows. Any one of the eight kinds of pratimoksha vows. Lapa pul dang, yeah, give them back. Shipa dang. Seni chun dang, that's the one everybody remembers. Lansum jur, missing two. Seni chun dang, yeah. Getache. Yeah, lose your root of virtue. Cut your root of virtue. I asked Rinpoche, as I promised I would, if there's any difference between Gewa and Getsa. Gewa means good deed. Getsa means root of virtue. And you know, I asked my scripture teacher in the monastery if there's any difference between them, you know. And they both said no, there's no difference between them. So Gewa and Getsa are pretty much the same. Rinpoche added that, I mean, so Gewa represents your accumulated good deeds. And if you get, for example, some very extreme form of wrong view, you you cut those good deeds. Getsache. He said the word root is meant to emphasize the causal part of virtue, meaning that if you cut them, they'll never flower or they'll never mature into something desirable. Okay. All right. Mr. Gross. No. Mr. Kish. I got a Bill Gross and a Bill Kish. Okay. Two results of keeping the vows. Well, you can go. Nekab debu hamedang tatu debu changjusum. Nekab debu hamedang tatu debu changjusum. Nekab debu means the short-term goal. The short-term benefit is ha and me. Which means what? Yeah, or me,
human,
to become a pleasure being or a human, short-term result. It's that first motivation where you don't want to slip below that line called animal. Okay. I mean, we're animal enough. Okay. Don't, the mind doesn't have to slip below that. Ani means what? And then, tatu devu changjusum. Tatu means ultimate result. It's changjusum, which is what? Yeah, sum. Why does it say three kinds of Buddhahood?
Three kinds of Buddhahood because there's nirvana, wisdom without remainder, and there is
three kinds of Buddhahood: the speech, the body, and the mind of Buddha.
Nah. Yeah, the three tracks. The three tracks. And most people never know that. I mean, there's three bodhicittas also. There's three forms of Senge. And that's why they say Mahayana bodhicitta. Because that's the bodhicitta of the third track. But there's also bodhicitta of the first two tracks. Meaning the wish for enlightenment of that track, which in the lower two tracks just means nirvana, a lower nirvana. Okay. That's a good question. I can't think of any difference between them, to tell you the truth. Okay. I mean, the state of... They're both Hinayana Nirvanas. In the Madhyamika Svatantrika system, you get there by seeing different levels of emptiness. And they don't call them emptiness. They call them selflessness. But I don't see... I don't think there's any difference in the results in the Nirvana between those two. Okay. So those, if somebody asks you on a final for the two results, you say short-term result, human or pleasure being Libra, long-term. By the way, which is, you know, we skip over it like blah, blah, blah because you have not seen your future lives. You know, because you are not aware of your future lives. And you, frankly, having grown up in America, you don't believe in future lives. And it's not part of your psyche. And when I say, hey, if you kept your pratimoksha vows, you could reach... you could stay a human. It doesn't click, you know. You don't say, wow, great, you know, that would be wonderful, you know. But it's really a huge accomplishment. One, probably as the people who live in America at this moment die, less than 400 or 500 of them will be born human or a god or a pleasure being. Okay? If the 200 million people living in America, as they die, most likely less than 500 would retain this kind of a life. Okay.
Could it be any kind of human? Like, could you be starving somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, that would be a great achievement. And most people never... it's a very depressing fact.
Would it be better to be a house cat?
No. No, because a house cat can't achieve enlightenment and nirvana in this life. Okay. All right. So it's really a big achievement. It's really not just something you should skip over on your, you know, and say, oh, you know, I'll just become a human or a pleasure being. According to all the scriptures, that is about the odds of the people living in the United States. You know, and people call me up all the time and say, you know, will Aunt May become, is she in Kansas or is she in Minnesota, you know? And I'm like, she's neither one, you know? And, you know, and then, And you don't want to tell them the truth, and it's very hard to tell the truth, you know.
Going back to what sort of karma does make someone ripen as a human, but as everyone's favorite example normally is someone, say, like Hitler, or, you know.
You finished class number 7, right? I mean, it's the habit of enjoying killing. So, killing in this life, killing things, you know, disrespecting the sacredness of life. Okay. Then the ultimate, Changjusum, to reach enlightenment in this life. Nirvana or enlightenment. Nirvana you cannot even imagine. I mean, you can imagine becoming back as a human, and only 1 in a million people will. But it's very hard to imagine Nirvana. It's almost unimaginable, the pleasure that it would be to be happy the whole day. I mean, to not have any kind of irritation or jealousy or anger or desire for things. You know, to be freed from that torment of having those thoughts in your skull is some kind of extreme pleasure. And you can't imagine it. You can't imagine what it would be like not to be irritated or stressed or have any kind of anxiety or any kind of selfishness or any kind of bad feeling about another human being. I mean, you can't even imagine what it would feel like. That's a smaller goal. And then the ultimate goal, you know, Buddhahood, just being in a Buddha paradise. And having the capacity to show up wherever any single living creature in the entire universe needs it at any given moment. And that would be kind of cool. You know? So like that. There's 10 bad deeds. I'm not going to go through them. You know them. You are assiduously avoiding them. We need two consistent consequences for each of the 10. What's called consistent consequences. Did you? What's that?
Oswaldo.
You ready? by killing, there would be two consistent consequences. Do you remember either one? Any of them?
Your life is short, or you get sick easily.
Yeah, your life is short, and you get sick easily. Okay, I think we'll just do these as a group. How's that? Your life is short, or you get sick easily. The reason why I really spent a long time on these 10 is that it's
not. I'm not into this thing where you're threatening somebody. You know, you're saying, "Oh, you shouldn't do that thing." You know.
I don't think it appeals to anyone. But the point is this: you can reconstruct the causes for your world. You know, you can be like an archaeologist or a detective. You can figure out what it was that got you here. If you don't have energy, you can figure out why you don't have energy. If your health is lousy, you can figure out why your health is lousy, and you can fix. You can do a lot to fix it. You know, so that's why I spent so much time on these 10. It's really the real causes for the messed up things in your own life, and you can fix them or you can address them. Okay, so if your life is short, or which you don't know yet, or if you get sick easily, avoid killing. Okay, stealing. Don't have enough money to live on, and what was the other one? Yeah, whatever property you do own is never, you never get to have the unique use of it yourself. You know, someone can cut your head off, and if it just doesn't bother you at all, it's not a result of bad karma. Okay.
Is your desire to have something yourself, a mental
effect,
uniquely yourself?
Yeah, it is. But it's more fun to use it. anyway, of course, there could be afflictions by being you know, attached to having it yourself, but it's also the result of a bad karma. If in a bad way you have to share it with other people, you don't get the use of something, the exclusive use of something yourself. It's a lot more fun to have a limousine than a New Jersey Transit bus. Okay. Sexual misconduct. Yeah, people around you, you can't count on the people around you. They're inconsistent because you are inconsistent. And that's a big one, you know. I mean, I tend to get upset or angry or disappointed when the people around me are not, when I can't count on them, or I don't get help that I think I need. But the point is I can get angry because I did it. Okay? All right? And that's the whole point. You know, I can't be angry because it was a result of my own sexual misconduct. I don't remember the sexual misconduct, but it doesn't mean anything. You know, and if I don't like having that problem, I could concentrate more on my own sexual misconduct. Okay. And the second one? Yeah, people are always coming on to your wife or your girlfriend or your husband or like that. You don't, your partners on, what I should say, people are attracted to your partner. People are always fighting with you to get your partner. Okay. Used to happen in high school a lot. Number four, lying. No one believes you even when you're telling the truth. And you know, if that bothers you, and it does happen, you can either get angry. We're going to do Bodhicharita. We're going to do Shantideva next year, probably the whole year. And it's full of this kind of thing. But if people don't believe you, don't get mad, don't get angry, just stop lying. Okay, that's what caused it. It's not them. You know, there's this big thing in the Madhyamika literature. It says Shantideva says, "What do you think? You know." Did somebody sent a construction crew down to hell to make hell? You know, who made hell? You know, who put all those pots of molten steel there? And who put all those demons with these spears to stab you? And do you think, you know, that they were drafted somewhere and sent down there by somebody? And, you know, construction crews went down and nailed hell together and stuff like that. It was created by your deeds. And by extension, the people around you at work, you know, you can't blame them for anything. You created them. You know, if you're tired of people who don't believe you, or if you're tired of people who don't help you clean up your morality. Okay. What was the second result? People are always deceiving you. People are always lying to you like that. And I don't know about you, but I have met people in my life, people who have been close to me. I can think of one in particular. And we would go around together to different places. And the other person would constantly be lied to. And their people would tell me the truth. And it was really weird. It was quite strange. You know. And this person was always paranoid that people were lying to them. And they were. And then I would talk to the same person, they'd tell you the truth. And it was really weird. You know, it was really weird. And so the other person was getting this paranoia about the whole world. And I'm trying to say, well, that's not what happens to me, you know. But there's a reason for it. Okay.
So if he gets mad, does he come back?
Yeah. Yeah.
Without him lying again?
Oh, no. And normally the anger would create some kind of other... in fact, I think anger leads to ugliness. Physical ugliness. You know, if you're not as pretty as you'd like to be, or as handsome as you'd like to be, I believe the cause is anger. Okay, but you have to study these things. Lying, slant, splitting up people, divisive talk. Yeah, the people around you are always in conflict. And, you know, you've been in offices where everyone is struggling against everybody else, and then you've been in offices where everyone seems to be working together as a team, and what causes it? It's you. Okay. Second one? yet you're around people who are bad. You know, and that's a big, that's a very bad karmic result, because then they make you worse. You know, to be around people who are not honest or who are not thoughtful or sensitive or who are, you know, not straight, and who are cruel is a very bad karmic result, because then they make you, they affect you. You know, nobody in this room would not be affected if they stayed for any length of time around somebody. You know, I've been in business, and I've had years when I had to work closely with people who just their idea of what lying was and what honesty was quite bizarre, you know. And it starts to affect you. You know, you start to think, well, maybe that's not so bad, or that's pretty smart. They seem to be successful, you know. And it's a very bad karma. Okay. Harsh words. Yeah, don't get mad at the garbage trucks and the Indian guys pulling down their metal shutters at midnight, you know. It was created by your... and by the way, this is... It's for real. If you study karma and the way karma is planted in your mind, you'll see that this is not just some kind of... I've seen many Western books where they said, all the Buddhists, they're just trying to explain why the world is like it is. They just made this up. It's a very interesting thing that Gautama made up to make people feel better about the world. You know, they'll understand the world better. They'll be able to explain why someone's yelling at them. And it comforts people. It was a real, you know, it was a real great advance in thinking that Gautama made this up, you know, to make people feel better. It's not like that. I mean, the garbage trucks in New York really were created, if they bother you, by your harsh speech. And if you don't like it, then don't do harsh speech anymore. And the whole environment is like that. Your whole world is like that. Everything in your world is like that, including your own nature, including your own thoughts, including your own moods and emotions. Okay, yeah.
Is it the garbage trucks themselves or the irritation?
It's the irritation at the garbage trucks. How's that? Yeah. Okay. Irritating garbage trucks. And then second one for harsh speech.
People are argumentative around you.
Yeah. And I've seen that too. I've seen people, I know people who just, you know, their first interaction with anybody is that the other person starts to attack them, and they're like, you know, and they start to get defensive because their first experience is always getting attacked, you know. And it is. It really is. They're not crazy. And then they start attacking all the time, and then it becomes like a habit. And like that. So. Okay. Number seven, idle talk.
No one respects what you say.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, I always see it in business meetings at work, you know, and there's always like two or three people who have a really good idea, and they raise their hand and they give this really good idea, and the boss looks at them like, are you stupid or what, you know, and to everyone else around the table it seems like a really good idea. And it is a good idea, but because they have done a lot of idle talk, just nobody considers what they say to be important. Okay. And what's the second one? Yeah, you have low self-esteem. Okay, and that's a very interesting karmic result. You don't have confidence in what you're going to do or say because no one thinks it's worth anything anyway. And it may be exactly the same thing that somebody else does that everybody praises. It's very funny. That's the emptiness of what you're doing. Okay, number eight. Yeah.
So when you spend an hour
I don't think so if the cure is gentle and positive. Because then the reason why some cures may work, the reason why some therapies may work is that actually you may be performing some kind of four powers. You know? And if the therapy is gentle and constructive, then you are collecting new good karma instead of reacting to it with anger or hatred or something like that. You know. But it's very interesting because it means that you have to be patient with your own faults. You know, you have to be loving about your own faults. You can't react to them with anger. You can react to them with a desire to change, a strong repulsion to your bad thoughts, but not with some kind of anger or frustration in that sense. It's very interesting. It says in the Abhidhamma that the only negative emotion which is virtuous is regret. It's very interesting. Craving, result of craving, number 8. You want things, okay? And you meet people, you know, I think all of us have, they say most beings in the desire realm, which is all of us, are here because we have some kind of, we had some kind of overwhelming desire. They say the people who are here because of anger are 1 in 100, and the other 99 are people who are here because of their desires. So that's much more common to be afflicted by desire than by continual desire. It's like low-level radiation, you know. They still don't know the effects, you know. Like I deal in topaz, blue topaz. It's created by low-level radiation, and it gives off low-level radiation. And we try to get the NEC to tell you what it does, and they can't. They say, we don't know, because you're exposed to all this radiation all day long, so we don't know what's the effect of being around these stones all day. We can't say. But desire is like a low-level radiation. You know, you have it all the day. And then you have anger comes up, you know, flares up once a day or twice a day or something like that. But low-level desire is supposed to be much more weakening and damaging to your heart than these outbursts of anger. Yeah. Let's see, so your personality is dominated by desire. And what's the second one? You never find any satisfaction. Okay, so we know what caused that. Number 9. Ill will, being happy when other people fail.
Never get what you need.
Or the first one was never find the help you need. And then secondly,
you're always hurting and being hurt by others.
Yeah, you're always hurting other people and being hurt by others. Okay. Last one, long views. Yeah, you have long views and.
Deceitful.
I don't know. What's the connection to deceitful? I'm not quite sure. Is it? I don't see. Do you get anybody have a proposal about the logic of the deceitful thing? I mean, that's what the text says, but I'm just curious.
You no longer accept karma. You no longer accept the importance of ethical behavior.
Hmm. Maybe it's a kind of lying or something to you. So I don't know. By the way, a lot of them are like that, which means you have to study Vinaya to really know the connections. And only a Buddha can see them perfectly. Yeah?
What's the cause of low energy? That was one of the things you mentioned.
Killing.
Killing. Yeah. Not respecting life. Do you guys want to take a break, or you want to... We're pretty close to finishing. You want to go straight through and have a night off? Okay. Environmental consequences. Let's do those together. Of killing. Yeah, the world that you live in is dangerous. People around you die young. And food and medicines don't have much power in your country or in your area, things like that. You take like aspirin and nothing happens. I can tell you. You know. Or you take Aleve and nothing happens. You know, you take 3 and nothing happens. Okay, stealing. I mean, he gives like a dozen different kinds of things that happen with crops. And I've seen it related to urban American life. You know, I've seen it related to urban life in the scriptures. To where, you know, you try business and it doesn't go right, and you meet people who, you know, struggle to make a business run, and it just never goes quite right. And then you meet other people, they have the golden touch and everything's going just right. And the people who have the golden touch, it wears off, and like Donald Trump, and then they're, you know, I remember his book came out, it was called The Art of the Negotiation, The Art of the Deal. And when it hit the newsstands, the newspaper came out and said he was bankrupt. You know, it was kind of funny to see the book and the newspaper next to each other on the newsstands, you know. I mean, it wears out. That wears out. So basically, from stealing, all your attempts to make a living don't go well. Okay, and just the business economy, urinary economy. It's very interesting. According to Buddhism, the idea of sharing wealth or the distribution of wealth is what? The idea that there's a limited amount of wealth and that people have to figure out the best way to distribute it is what? It's just false. You know, there's no reason why the whole world economy couldn't be great forever. You know, there's no reason why some people have to be poor and some people have to be rich. It's not like there's a limited amount of possessions and that the problem is that they're not distributed properly. That's not the truth. The truth is that everybody in the planet could be poor or everybody in the planet could be wealthy and comfortable if they collected the right causes. Okay. It's interesting. Number three, wrong sex causes what? Yeah, stinky and filthy. Okay. I always think of this food container on 39th Street outside the door there. I mean, every time I went past it, I was thinking, what kind of sexual misconduct did I do, you know? and there's this thing about in your life where... I don't know if you've experienced it, but in certain times of your life where nothing tastes good, nothing seems enjoyable, you know, you go to a movie, it doesn't quite seem to be very exciting, you go on vacation, it doesn't quite work out, you go to a restaurant to have a good dinner, it doesn't quite click, you know, and then you have other periods in your life when everything is vibrant, colors are vibrant, music is vibrant, food is vibrant, your friends are vibrant, when you go somewhere, it's like electricity. Those are all a result of sexual misconduct or keeping your sexual mores. Okay. Number four, lying. These had mainly it broke down into two things. One was any kind of work you do with other people, cooperative efforts like a project that you undertake with a group of people, they don't work out. Okay. If you've been lying. And then... you live in a world where people are cheating each other, and they also mention fear in a lot of these, and they mention it here. Like there's muggers, there's robberies, there's natural disasters, there's you know dangerous things in your environment, okay? Because of lying, okay? Because of trying to split up people, well. Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, you were talking about a certain Dharma center in California where, I mean, the road is like this and the whole place is like this, you know. And they wanted to know what karma would fix their road, you know. And it was this, you know. It was not divisive speech, you know, not engaging in divisive speech. They wanted to, we were exploring in a class in California the karmic reasons for having a dirt road that comes to their house, which is very dangerous. And it's on this edge of a mountain, it's always getting washed out and stuff like that. And ultimately, it's divisive speech. And if they wanted to fix it, should they go to the county and ask for it to be fixed, or should they do the four powers and work on divisive speech? You know, clearing up divisive speech karma. And that's the answer. That's how to fix their road. Then the county would come out and fix it, you know. And that's the only thing that would make the county come out and fix it. And that's kind of cool.
But this token must be really cause of bad karma to be born in Tibet.
What's that?
By the same token, it's the same karma to be born in Tibet.
Oh, yeah, if it bothers you, if it hurts you. Like Rinpoche's whole life in Lhasa, as I understand it. It was pleasant walks from Sera to Lhasa on a flat road. You know, so he didn't have that karma. But he did when he ran away from Tibet, if he was a normal person, which he's not. But, you know, when they ran away and then they had to go over these huge mountains and suffer. Yeah. If it bothers them, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
The Dalai Lama is not exactly thrilled with what the Chinese are doing with the father's.
Excuse me?
The Dalai Lama is bothered by what the Chinese are doing.
You never know. You never know. You don't know? Okay. All right. Harsh words? Harsh words, the ground is covered with dangerous things, glass, thorns, things like that. And again, there's many things to fear. Okay, talking meaninglessly, nothing ever ripens at the right time, and there's no place for you to take your rest. You know, there's no quiet place in that city where you can really go safely and hang out on the grass and enjoy the trees and things like that. Okay, from idle talk. And again, many things that make you afraid. Number eight, from coveting, it's very interesting. From coveting other people's things, the things which you yourself come to have just are constantly deteriorating. Like, if you get a house, if the plumbing's always breaking. You know people have houses like that. You know, and it ends up to be this huge suffering as the house starts to deteriorate. Or you get a car. You know, you get the one out of 100 that came off the assembly line with everything that's going to break. And you know, people go crazy with the new car that's causing them all this suffering because little things keep breaking. And then there's Rinpoche's car, you know, 10 years later, never been fixed for anything. You know, it's a different kind of karma, okay? Number nine, ill will. You live in a world of chaos where there's a lot of disease and countries are fighting with each other and hurting each other. And also harmful things like insects or snakes or muggers or things like that in your world. So if you want to wipe out crime in New York, what do you do? For you. Yeah, don't be happy when other people fail. Okay? That's the real way to wipe out crime in New York. It's very interesting. This is the truth, by the way. I'm not just joking around. I mean, it's not to hire more cops, and it's not to pay them more, and it's not to give everybody more money or something like that. It's to stop having ill will towards people, and there won't be crime in New York. Very interesting. Number 10. Basically, number 10 is you'll be born in a place where there's no Dharma, and people where you live will have wrong views. Specifically, they'll think that things which are unhappiness are happiness. Like, they'll think that worldly things will make them happy. I mean, I guess it's trying to say you'll be born into a material culture. Okay. Alright, we're almost finished. Elizabeth, you want to do one? The five main persons or in the lineage of the Lamrim. Starting with? Okay, and then second level. Yeah, Maitreya and Manjushri. Yeah, Asanga and Nagarjuna. Atisha, who combines them. And then all the other lamas. Yeah. Okay, cool. Almost finished. Four special qualities of Lamrim. Denpa Thamje Gyalme Tokpa Dang. I'll go over them quick because we're almost out of time. Denpa Thamje Gyalme Tokpa means you will see that no teaching in Buddhism contradicts any other teaching in Buddhism. And I admit, and I openly admit that it doesn't seem to you that way now. But if you study the Lamrim deeply, it'll dawn on you that it's all perfectly consistent with each other. Okay. Number two is Surya Madhu Dhamma Chala. I mean, since any teaching you pick up seems to be personal advice to yourself. Gyalwe Gomba Delakti Nyepa means you begin to see why the Buddha taught different things, and you begin to see the place they have in getting you to enlightenment. Okay? And I gave the example of like Buddhist logic. According to Gyaltsub Jay, Tsongkhapa's greatest disciple, the kindest thing Tsongkhapa ever did for him was to teach him Buddhist logic. I've been afraid to teach Buddhist logic in New York because everyone would die of boredom. You know? So, but if you come to a point where you can see where that applies to your enlightenment directly, you've achieved the third point of the Lamrim. You've understood the third benefit. Okay? And the fourth great characteristic is Nechi Chimbi Yansa Le Kyang Sum, which means if you study the Lam Rim, which gives you this incredible overview of all the Buddhist teachings, you will never again put down any of the Buddhist teachings, which would be a huge mistake. You will never again say, I like 90% of it, but that stuff is stupid. You know, that Vinaya stuff, it's not like emptiness and bodhisattva stuff. It's kind of boring, and I think it was meant for ancient India, and I don't see really where it has a place in the modern times, you know. That's called the great chasm, the great mistake, thinking something like that. If you study Lam Rim well, you study the interrelationship of all the Buddhist teachings, you'll never fall into that. Okay. Qualities of a proper Lama. Okay? I'll go through them real quick. Controlled in the sense of having an ethical way of life. Peaceful in the sense of knowing how to meditate. Completely peaceful in the sense of understanding emptiness, having wisdom. Exceeding qualities in the sense of having personal qualities which are much greater than the student's qualities. Having effort in the sense of having dedicated their life to achieving what's good for themselves and what's good for others in an ultimate way. Rich in scripture, having studied the three collections of scripture. Having understood emptiness. Infinitely preferable if they have seen emptiness directly. There is no comparison between a teacher who has seen emptiness directly and one who hasn't. A master teacher in the sense of knowing the capacity of their students and following it well. The image of love in the sense of not teaching because of wanting to gain anything from their student, but teaching the student whatever will benefit them the most at any particular time. Kyowapang, overcome distaste, which means they never get tired of teaching. Okay, no matter how bad the students are. Okay, all right. The next two questions have to do with what are the karmic causes of these qualities in the Lama? A lot of people ask me, what's the point of this question? You know, and it was this. It was that it's to point out the emptiness of those 10 qualities. Okay? What is the emptiness of those 10 qualities? It means that the teacher may have the karma to see all of those qualities in himself or herself. I mean, the teacher may, for example, have seen emptiness directly. And the teacher may, for example, only be motivated by a concern for the student in everything they do. And everything they do only to teach their students something. And so from the teacher's point of view, maybe these two things. A, they really have seen emptiness directly. B, whatever they do, even if it seems strange, is only motivated in order to teach their students something. But the karma of the student may be to see that, look at that same person and not understand that they have seen emptiness directly, and also to think that some of their activities are improper or seem strange like that. And that would be the student's karma. It's very interesting. So that would be the emptiness of these 10 qualities. You know, does that mean you should follow a teacher who's breaking their morality? No. Okay? And that's the other thing that you have to say in the same breath. You know, I mean, if you have to make a judgment based on the best of your knowledge, but you have to also be aware that if your mind was more pure, you might be seeing something completely different. I mean, at this level, you should not follow a person who is breaking their morality. But also be aware that like Maitreya and the Asanga and the dog, did we go over that? Yeah. I mean, just be aware that that as your own mind becomes more and more pure, you will be seeing more sacred qualities where you never expected them. and where you could not see them before, not because they weren't there, not because Maitreya wasn't sitting in the cave for 12 years next to a Sangha, because the Sangha just wasn't pure enough to see it. You know. So be careful in how you relate to... Be careful in judging people. I guess I want to... It's the difference between judging and... you can't judge another person's activities, but if they are unwholesome, you must avoid them. Okay? Like I can say, I don't know why monks and nuns in America are disrobed. I can't judge them, but I can say that it's a bad activity. You know, disrobing is a very, very bad thing. But I can't judge those people who have disrobed. I can't tell. I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. You know, I can tell you it's a bad activity. And I can tell you that I would not want to be too close to those people. Or, you know, that I might be affected by them or something like that. That's a distinction I'm trying to make. When your own mind is pure enough, a lot of the things that you think you see now, you will realize are defects in your own mind. But in the same breath I say, you must follow these 10 rules for seeking out your shenyin. But eventually, I mean, find a good shenyin, and eventually the things that you think are wrong, you may find out that they are very holy persons. Really? Can I say really? That they are really very holy people. Can I say that? Can I say the liquid was really water? No. It's not contradictory for them to be a drunkard and a holy man at the same time. It's not contradictory. You cannot follow a drunkard. You must follow a holy man. Which one was Trungpa? Chogyam Trungpa. Which one was he? Yeah, he's a... I mean, it's a very difficult thing. You can't follow a drunkard.
So you just have to find
him. Well, we said, how do you find a shenyin? And that's the whole point. Ultimately, that's the point of this question. How do you find that incredibly holy being who will... take you personally to Buddha Paradise?
By these 10 factors.
By the way you lead your life.
Huh?
By the way you lead your life.
Yeah, clean up your life. Clean up your own mind. And what we said was you don't have to get on a plane and go to India, okay? If you clean up your own life, they will be forced to come to you. It's like putting out honey for flies. Clean up your mind, they have to come. They will appear. Sometimes where and in whom you least expect it. You know. But that's how you find your shenyin. And finding your shenyin is the holiest thing I can teach you. You know, the holiest thing I can say in all of these classes is, you know, clean up your heart to the point where your shenyin will come to you. Can come to you. Like Maitreya could come to a Sangha. You know, he couldn't. He was there all the time, but you couldn't see him. Yeah. You have to find a shenyin. So put out the bait of your pure activity and mind. Gilma, you had a question?
No, you
asked. Okay. All right. I'm not going to go through the four powers. We just went through it. But four powers should become for you something very, very important to you. Okay, it should become a daily practice. You should be constantly applying it to the last time you got mad at your boss, which was today. Okay, the last time you had desire for such and such a thing, which was this afternoon. And before the karma gets too powerful, apply the four powers. I can't do it for you. I can tell you it works. And you have to just get to where it becomes an automatic reaction. We just did the fourth noble... Arya trance. So I don't have to go over those again. And the last question is the sweetest question, which is, why is bodhicitta like the alchemical elixir? And how does that relate to dependent origination? What's that?
I was going to try to answer.
Go ahead.
That the bodhisattva intention
has to be the motivation for doing good deeds, and if you have that intention for doing those good deeds, you wipe out the bad karma, not only for this life, but all of your life.
That's true, but also a good deed becomes like gold.
Like gold, yeah.
Yeah, instead of just temporary. Yeah, instead of just a temporary good result. Okay, that's that. First of all, I wanted to also thank, there was a lot of people working on all, this stuff has become, as the classes got larger, this has become a lot of work. And this was the first time when I really had students helping me translate the text. Aura and Elizabeth did a lot of it. The monks who live here helped with a lot of it. And that was really nice. It saved me, well, it was a great help. First of all. Secondly, I mean, a lot of people spent a lot of time typing them up, cleaning them up, Xeroxing them. They're not self-existent, okay? And that was, Aura did a lot, Tussie did a lot, John Stilwell was involved. I think there were people involved that I don't know about. Elizabeth helped, Annie Thelma did a lot of them. Ellie did some. And I don't know everybody else. But what's happening, and then I want to thank the, you know, the papers are being graded by, these monks stay up all night and do the papers. I mean, it's a lot. It's hundreds and hundreds of papers. And they're also doing, you know, hundreds of papers for correspondence course students. So they don't get anything out of it but the work, you know. So I think if you could thank those people as you see them, as you meet them, you know, thank them. Last thing to say is that I really believe in Vinaya, and I look forward to Vinaya being very strong in the United States. I think it's a good time for it to start. I myself, as I taught it, got a lot more appreciation for it, and began to become, I don't know, it just started to make me happier and happier as I started to get in more and more into the mood of Pratimoksha, you know. And I couldn't have that happen, or I could never get those results without my teachers. And also I couldn't have all those results unless I had people who come to help me talk about it, and that's you people. And I just want to thank you very much for that, because I need that. And if people come who we call who are of the same spiritual aspirations, you know, and if I'm around people like that, for me it's a great blessing. Personally, it's a very great blessing. So I have to thank you very much for that, because it makes my life very happy, you know. So I thank you for that. Yeah.
You're great teachers.
So rejoice, okay? Rejoice for a few minutes, okay? And then we'll go home.
Okay. Is it proper to mention this November 10th?
I don't mind at all. I'm afraid you'll squat, you'll lose your house, but I don't mind. Banzan has an announcement.
Just a short one. Vishal was kind enough to come to place which are Zen meditation place to deliver a talk on the subject of Heart Sutra, which is major text in sect I'm from. And if you want to come for the purpose of listening to his commentaries to Heart Sutra, you're welcome. It's November 10th.
Is it November 17th?
No.
Wait a minute.
Uh-oh.
No, we made a Google. I thought it was the 17th.
Huh?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought it was the 17th. Is 17th?
No.
We have to talk. I'm sorry. We have to talk.
Is 17th not clear?
So it's not clear which.
It is,
I'm sorry.
Mid-November. And there's fun of mine.
Can you write it up here? Jose. Is anything possible for you? That's all. No?
I will get there for you. I'll
okay.
All
right. Oh, boy.
Is it a one day?
No, it's kind of like whole day meditation, which starts at 9 and it ends at 5. And within this time, get there with this and you are either welcome to come for whole purpose of sitting still with us, or you can come just for the purpose of listening to yourself, which would be most probably in the afternoon. And the place is quite small, so it's a matter of like thinking over and then calling us. For sure, all of us would not squeeze into it. So it is Sunday.
Where's the place?
It's Brooklyn, Sunset Park.
Whether or not Monzon's doing that, you know, since there's no break, I didn't get to come around to everybody and ask them if they're going to transcribe or take any students. So I'll just stand here on the way out very quickly. I won't hold you up. Just give me your name, and if you want to take any, if you've had two courses, if you want to take any students, and if you want to transcribe. So we'll go very quickly. His name? Yes or no? Thanks.
One more note.
Okay. Everybody should have one of these things. It's about the October calendar, the 3 June bookstore. And I'm supposed to read you what's going on. So October 13th, art exhibit. October 19th, performance of Japanese food in Japanese. October 25th, poetry reading. And then there's an art exhibit for the last week in October. And there will be more of these soon when people want to go. And people who want to contribute to Ken Rinpoche's Long Life Tutors in the after class, everybody should give at least $2 to put your name on the list.
So meditate for 3 minutes. Be happy. Okay. Be happy about very much, and please keep it, okay? I mean, the Drupe Chupa, the ultimate offering to a teacher is to keep your practice, you know. So try not to lie, try not to steal anything, try not to say anything bad to some people, and it will really make you happy. Last thing, I would really hope in November that we could have some kind of a ceremony. It'll probably have to be in New Jersey. Rinpoche has said he doesn't feel well enough to travel much, that he could grant at least lifetime layman's vows. No reason not to take them. You're not going to kill anybody. You're not going to steal anything. You're not going to commit adultery. And drinking is a waste of money and time. So no reason not to do it. You're not going to lie about emptiness. So you might as well just take them anyway. It's a lot more powerful. And consider taking higher ordinations if it's in your mind. I think it looks like maybe tomorrow we will close the deal in Connecticut, which means we'll have a big place for a monastery and a nunnery. And, you know, as you get older in life, you might want to consider it. There's not much else to do. And in Tibet it is really a custom. You mean you get to a certain age where you've tried everything and it looks like your life is going to start heading towards spiritual things exclusively. Keep it in mind. Don't Semdak Shu in Tibetan means keep the possibility in your heart that you could do it. Any time's okay. Alright? And we have a nice place for you and it would be wonderful. It would be wonderful to have a nice solid group of monks and nuns. So don't think it's impossible. You never know. Keep in one corner of your heart the possibility of doing that. It'd be a very great thing to do. Is that what? Yeah, okay. All right, meditate for 1 minute. I have to, yeah.
Will you notify us if we choose to take a
look? Yeah, I'll do it in, we'll try to shoot for late November, and then I'll announce it in the classes in early November. Just be happy. You create a lot more merit if you're just happy about it. So be happy, okay? I'm going to be happy too.
Yeah.